Today's program is brought to you by the International Culinary Center, offering courses that range from classic French techniques in culinary, pastry, and bread baking to Italian studies to management, from culinary technology to food writing, from cake making to wine tasting. For more information, visit culinarycenter.com.
I'm Julia Tertian, host of Radio Cherry Bomb. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to A Taste of the Past. I'm your host, Linda Palacio, on this half-hour journey through culinary history. And you know, we're all familiar with the Mediterranean diet, or so it's called, Mediterranean diet, and certainly there have been plenty of books written about it. Nancy Harmon Jenkins just won an award for her book written quite a while ago. And many authors have been writing books similar to that, not calling it the Mediterranean diet, but now we have on the table a brand new book called Mediterranean Vegetarian Feasts, and it's about the Mediterranean diet with a little twist that you probably wouldn't even notice if it didn't say vegetarian in the title. And my guest is Aglaia Kremetsi, and Aglaia is a Greek food writer and journalist. In fact, she's considered one of Greece's foremost cooking authorities. She lives on the island of Chia and off the coast of Greece, where she runs a cooking school as well. Busy woman. In addition to over six cookbooks, Aglaia has written articles for blogs and magazines such as Atlantic, Suburb, Bon Appetit, you name them, they're all in there, all the biggies. And this new book, Mediterranean Vegetarian Feasts, explores the roots and the leafy tops, I just had to say that, of Mediterranean cuisine in a presentation of wonderful dishes. In fact, Alice Waters wrote in a blurb for it, with respect for tradition and place. Aglaia, welcome so much to the show.
I'm so glad to be here. It's such a wonderful place.
In this book, I have to mention that the photographs are penned by Penny de los Santos. They are magnificent, they do help make the book. I mean, it makes you want to pour through the book and explore each and every recipe, and they are delicious recipes. But I want to get back to what Alice Waters wrote in her blurb, that you have a respect for tradition and place. And you mention in the beginning of your book about Mediterranean methodology. Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, these are recipes that I grew up eating, basically. I mean, that's what we ate in the old days, because I'm quite old, and I grew up at a time when eating meat was kind of like a festive thing.
A luxury.
Right? A luxury, exactly. For festive days or for family occasions. So this was what we ate every day, and I loved it. And whenever we had these festive meat dishes, I preferred all the trimmings around the meat that more than, you know, the actual meat. And it's, to me, this is what I cook every time, you know, every season, because we have a garden in care. And it's not exactly a school that we're running. It's a kind of like a culinary vacation. And we do it just before the season and after.
I'm making my reservation already, so just mark it down.
Okay, absolutely. You should definitely come.
I will.
So, so we have a garden, but our soil is not very good, as it was in the old times. People had small gardens, and they had to use up everything that they had since antiquity. So that's why I think Mediterranean cooking is so inventive and interesting, and it's very similar all around the Mediterranean, because we have the same ingredient, and because it is ingredient-based.
Right. Well, in fact, you... You say Mediterranean diet, and it is this combination.
I don't call it diet.
No, a Mediterranean. I mean, no, I'm sorry. Feast. Exactly. Feast. Vegetarian feast. Sorry. I can't get that out of my head.
It's a feast. Okay. I think it's a feast. I mean, to me, it's a feast, and to people who taste it, it's a feast. I don't want to consider it. I mean, it might be healthy, but the health aspect is a bonus. it's taste and flavor that is the important
right.
thing to
so
me.
You're one
least.
Of those people that go to a restaurant and you order because of the side dish, not because of what the
basically,
main dish is, right?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
That's the way I,
yeah.
I understand that completely. you know, you do come from Greece and you've written a lot of Greek cookbooks, but you've also written a lot of Mediterranean cookbooks. Mm-hmm. And I noticed that a lot of the dishes are draw from the Mideast, particularly Syria and Lebanon, mm-hmm. and North Africa
uh-huh.
as well.
Uh-huh.
In this, what is it, like spices and paste? You're very keyed into the pantry and the larder. So how do these influences play in?
Well, surprising as it might seem, in my country, in Greece, a lot of these old, ancient or medieval recipes have been kind of like forgotten. But you will find them as they are described in ancient texts. You go to North, for example, in Tunisia, once I found something that it was described in an ancient text. This famous barley gruel that people fed on with pepper and other things, and that was served as breakfast in Tunisia. And this is exactly what you hear, you know, with all these spices, because contrary to what people think, ancient cooking was very spicy. I mean, the cooking of because they had to make the vegetables and the gruels that were the base of their eating every day of common people, because meat and all that what is mentioned in the text was only for the gentry and only for the special occasions. They were eating vegetables and kind of like the staple was some kind of either barley flatbreads or a barley gruel. Mm-hmm. And going to Tunisia, I found it, and I found a lot of other things. For example, in Israel, on a trip in Israel, in a Yemeni village, I found something that I have heard, that I have read about, and that I couldn't understand what it was. And it was a pulp made with fenugreek, and I read, you know, when I had read it, I said, what do they mean by pulp with fenugreek? Well, if you go there, you see that they soak the fenugreek and then they beat it and it becomes like a big jelly. It expands and they use that for the shug, as a medium to add the shug, which is this very hot sauce that the Yemenis use. So there are things, it's a little bit, the Middle East and North Africa are a little bit like a time capsule where you can find things. And sometimes I take inspiration from this. This is not that I use, I you know, in the book I'm not using, you know, exactly these dishes. But I take inspiration and I use things that enhance the flavor of what I get from my garden or from my neighbor's garden. I try to I always cook seasonally, and I try to come up with different dishes every
season. You know, you, I mean, you put that so clearly for me, that those countries are like a time capsule, because so many of the same dishes being cooked. I love that. Mm-hmm. That's mm-hmm. great. You just mentioned about the gruels. So that's what I wanted to know. What were some of the different ingredients you feel that are different than what you've included in recipes before that you've included here? In one that drew my attention right away, it was towards the beginning, is kishk.
Yeah, kishk. Kishk is very, it's almost exactly the same like the sour pasta that we make in Crete, which is called xinochondros. Xino means sour. Chondros is the ancient word for coarsely ground wheat or any grain.
Right.
So kishk is exactly the same thing.
So it's a ferment, basically.
It's
a fermented pasta.
Yes.
Right.
You mix it with soured milk or with milk and yogurt these days, mm-hmm. and you let it ferment, and then you dry it, and you keep it in the pantry, and you make soups with it. We make pilafs. You can add it as a flavoring. It's really wonderful. And I, in my recipe, I also make it with barley, because I believe barley is somehow a forgotten grain, and it's extremely, I mean, you have pearl barley in this country. In Europe, pearl barley is not that much used. but also barley as a flour to make bread. Mm-hmm. In my mix, because the old Greek mix of flours to make them. The everyday bread had barley, and we also have the pure barley rusks, or let's say savory biscotti, because people don't know the word rusks, it seems. So these are
we do have people in England who like to listen. They do understand.
Apparently this is an English a British rusks. Word, but think about them as biscotti. I mean, you shape them into a loaf and you cut them pure barley, or half barley and half wheat flour. But barley doesn't keep much if you make it into a bread. So you cut it into slices and you dry it completely in a very low oven. Mm-hmm. And it keeps almost indefinitely. And that was the staple, especially on the islands. Because believe it or not, on the Greek islands, one of the most expensive ingredients is wood to burn in the oven. Because there are no forests and there are just a few shrubs that dry. So you need to kind of like conserve. You make a bread and then you dry it very low as the oven, cools down. Mm-hmm. You let it overnight to dry, and you keep it to eat every day. You reconstitute it, underwater, or you just crumble it and add a little bit of tomatoes, chopped tomatoes and all, and you have a wonderful salad. So this is the Greek kind of bread salad with barley bread.
Right. Well, of course, they had communal ovens back in the day, and now you understand, one can understand why, mm-hmm. because, you needed a place that had one fire going and keep it going, right?
Absolutely. Less fuel. Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And not only that, but, you can distinguish the pitas, the pies, the phyllo pies of the north of Greece or of central Greece are big pies because they had wood. They had, but on the islands, they make tiny little, turnovers, which are often fried.
Oh, interesting.
So it's because that's what they had. So it's everything is what you have and how you can make the best of what you have.
Now, you mentioned you took these barley rusks and maybe you threw a few tomatoes on them. Okay. Tomatoes. These aren't ancient traditional recipes. We're talking New World foods. You think of a lot of the foods, and it's so much New World food that goes into the Mediterranean diet, which should be called modern Mediterranean food.
yes. It's kind of like one of the most, people don't think about, people forget that tomatoes were brought, especially in Greece, they were brought much later than Italy, which was in the beginning of the 20th century, basically.
And they were brought from Italy. They came from Italy to Greece.
Yeah. Exactly. In my grandmother's time, for example, we made bean soup, which was kind of like a family staple. We made it without tomatoes. And even in my first grade book, that was, we had this, the traditional, the family sits around and eats bean soup, and there are the ingredients, in the book. In my first grade, how do you call it? The book that you learn how to read.
The primer, the reader.
And there are all the ingredients, and there is no tomatoes. In the 60s, the late 50s, beginning of the 60s, there were no tomatoes. Mm. I mean, because they were kind of like, they were starting to be a household thing. And then people couldn't get enough of them. They added so much tomato and so much tomato paste that it became a little bit weird.
Yeah. And when you mentioned tomato paste in particular, mm-hmm. is used so much in a lot of the additions that
very
you put
much.
Into things.
Yeah. Very much. Tomato paste for us and for all the cooks around the Mediterranean is like soy sauce for the Asians. That's what you have to think about it as. But we have very good quality tomato paste. And when you use tomato paste, I advise people to get the best quality tomato paste because it makes such
a big
difference.
Or make your own.
But if you have tomatoes, you can make your own. Absolutely. But the thing is that if you don't have your own, you get the best kind of tomato paste, and not the thing called passata. Passata is not a tomato paste. Right. People think that, people told me one day, I was cooking somewhere and they said, oh, so you use, no, that's not passata. I mean, you can use passata if you have a good passata.
Or put it in a pan and reduce it.
Exactly. But a good tomato paste and the Greek tomato paste actually is available in this country and you can order it. You can eat it with a spoon.
That's great. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about some of the recipes that are in this book, so stay tuned.
National Culinary Center is a proud sponsor of the HeritageRadioNetwork.org. The ICC, with locations in New York and California, provide cutting-edge education to future chefs, restaurateurs, and wine professionals. We're proud to claim Dan Barber, Bobby Flay, and David Chang among our honored alumni. This is Dorothy Cann Hamilton from Chef Story. Check out our ICC website at internationalculinarycenter.com.
Hello, this is Mark Ladner from Del Posto, and you're listening to Heritage Radio Network.
Okay, we are back on A Taste of the Past, and I'm sitting here with Aglaia Cremesi. We're talking about Mediterranean Vegetarian Feasts, a beautiful new book that just came out. In fact, it is the sale. It's on sale now, right?
Oh,
it is?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
Oh, yes.
I know it's very fresh, hot off the press.
It's quite fresh, yes.
Something that just intrigued me, and I do want to talk about it, and that is how you coined your phrase of cooking with vegetables and using everything called nose-to-tail vegetarian cooking. Tell our listeners what you mean by that.
Well, I mean that where I come from, I told you that we don't have a good soil. We have a lot of sun, very little rain, and not a very good soil. It's very stony. So we have to bring in soil, which is quite expensive, and we have to also pay quite dearly for the water that we need to water the plants, especially in the months that there is no rain, which is from April up until late November. Usually there is hardly any rain. So we have to use, and that's how it was in the old days. Even people who bought, you know, things, they didn't. I see here in the kitchens, for example, how they just chop all the stems from the parsley and they throw them out. We don't throw out the stems of the parsley or the stems of the kale. The kale. I was at the New Union Square Market yesterday, and I saw how and also in D.C. In the farmers market in D.C. Kale is extremely expensive. And I would tell my husband, because he's always complaining that I'm planting kale or, you know, any kind of other greens like that early. And he said, oh, we pay so dearly for the water. I would tell him how much it sells for here. Right. It's even more expensive. So you don't throw away the stems of the kale. You just chop them finely and you add them to the pan and you cook them a little bit more than you do the more tender leaves. Right. But we don't throw anything away.
Excellent. You have a wonderful recipe for spinach stems, for the bottoms of the spinach stems. Not only I have not cooked it because my fresh spinach is gone, but
it's gone already.
Yeah, from my garden, right? Yes.
Oh, mine! It's just starting to sprout.
Yeah, well, I live a lot further north than you do. But it is. It's also beautiful to look at.
Yeah.
Tell us about that particular.
Well,
recipe.
The bottom of the spinach has a much more earthy and kind of like sweet taste. It's the root. It needs a bit more cleaning, but it's kind of like pinkish, and I have a picture in the book. And you just steam it, and then you can just drizzle it with olive oil and lemon juice, or you can make an egg and lemon sauce, or you can add it, I mean, in both in Greece and in Turkey, in southern Turkey. People add it to, they cook it together with a little meat, and they make, you know, a dish for the whole family.
Yeah, and it's it just as beautiful to look at. Well, I am a great
because
believer.
It's pinkish.
Yeah,
because yes.
It's pink and a little green. I'm a great believer in using stems too. It makes preparation a lot easier too. You chop it up and just put
exactly.
the ends in the pan first.
Exactly.
And then the tops go
absolutely.
In. Right?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. And I love how the colors, there's so many more colors come from the stem usually,
yes.
you know.
Yes.
Dish. You have been on a wonderful book tour these past few days or weeks, and you're continuing on to the West Coast. In fact, I read an article that Joe Yonan just wrote the other day in the Washington Post because you were there and talked about, you just mentioned the lemon sauce.
The egg and lemon sauce.
Yes.
The egg and lemon
and,
sauce.
And so you've been able to present a lot of this cooking to the people who come out for the media tour. Tell us about that.
Well, I'm very fortunate to work at Zaitinia, which is Jose Andres's Middle Eastern and Greek restaurant in D.C., and I'm one of the grandmothers of the restaurant, as Jose calls us. And I really enjoy very much working in the kitchen with the chefs, and we're always, you know, bringing out new dishes and all that. And here in New York, a wonderful chef, Effie Naon of Bustan, took my book and created a beautiful lunch recently for the book. And I'm so grateful to both Jose and Chef Effie Naon for doing this wonderful thing for me.
It really, I think, helps bring the book to life for people who aren't, you know, aren't familiar with this type of cooking and the ingredients.
And Joe, and I cooked together with Joe Yonan, and he, I mean, I so much enjoyed doing that. I mean, I would love to go to each city and go together in the kitchen with a food editor and cook together. So, because it's a different thing, I mean, to convince people who are really overworked what is interesting and what the book is about. You can show them, you know,
right.
It's easier to show them.
Well, I wish we had a kitchen here in our
yes.
radio studio. That
yes.
would be
yes.
fun. I'm going to propose that one of these days, right? Because I really do think that's fun and really gives it extra dimension. What I wanted to bring up was that what you've done with this, you have taken this tradition of cooking and all these heritage recipes that have been developed over centuries, but you've really made them accessible for the home cook, and particularly for the Western home cook, which I think is interesting.
Well, that is my purpose. My purpose is to make bring people back to the kitchen and make them want to cook vegetables. That's why we included all these photographs. I think that I will tempt people to go back to the kitchen and
Absolutely.
Cook. And the recipes are, I chose the easiest recipes. And I also give people a game plan. Go to the farmer's market, choose the best things that you think, I mean, what attracts you more, and then go to the index and find my idea what to do with them. And I also start with some kind of basic preparations, things that people can do as soon as they buy the fresh and seasonal ingredients, and so that they have them half prepared and they can turn them into 3 or 4 or 5 different dishes during the week.
Mm-hmm.
So I have this kind of like game plan.
Which really is a traditional way of cooking. I mean, economy. You know, food was scarce. Food
exactly.
was hard to come by.
Exactly.
And
as we said, you don't have a lot of, in the old days, you didn't have a lot of wood to burn, to have fires and do so. You try to make the best every day and then kind of like turn it. It has, almost every recipe has a second day and then a third yeah. day. So I'm talking about this.
Excellent. Excellent. So, well, you know, you mentioned wood fire again, and I just have to touch on a wonderful picture I saw of outdoor cooking, and yeah. it was with the Gaska, the outdoor oven.
Yes, the outdoor portable oven of the Balkans. Yes. Because this is like a big dome, but it's metal, and you just need very few burning coals or charcoal, and you just add them at the top of and at the bottom, and you can bake a pie, you can bake vegetables, and everything takes a very interesting kind of like slightly smoky flavor, which is very important, especially in vegetarian cooking. That's why I have I use smoked olives, and I explain how to make them, or smoked garlic, and also smoked cheese, which is available everywhere, or you can smoke your own. But mm-hmm. This is really important that I don't use. All the recipes are real recipes that people cooked from. I may have given them my personal twist, but they are not kind of made up. They are not contrived recipes. They are not recipes where you throw in all the things that are so-called, or the so-called healthy things
fancy ingredients.
No fancy ingredients,
right. No. Well, you are known for making use of everything and putting up food for the future. Your pantry is I've heard to be admired and envied. That's something that not everyone has the privileged time or ability to do.
Well, the pantry is not only it's again. Again, the idea of making a pantry is because I have two lemon trees that if you look at them, they are not much to look at, but they produce so many lemons twice a year that I'm really, and they are wonderful and aromatic. So I have to make a lot of things. I make marmalade, I make preserved lemons, I make lemon curd, I make all these things because I don't want to throw these things. I mean, it's such a shame to go waste.
Right.
And the same thing with, with tomatoes, with some greens, with beans, with favas. So you just, you have to do something.
We wait all year for the season to come around, and then we have a plethora of whatever it is we're growing. And so, yes, it's sort of our duty to do something with them.
Sure.
Or go to the green, if you have a green market. If you're lucky to have a farmer's market or a green market nearby, to take advantage of it and put up food for the rest of the time. That's very good. Okay, I want to leave our listeners with a little something from the book, because right now we are talking in early November, and quinces are in the market, and quinces, which you could never find years ago. I was fortunate to have an old quince tree years ago until I lost it in a storm and cried, but it would give me like maybe 5 quinces a year.
Yeah.
People don't quite know what to do other than, boil it with sugar to death to make a paste or a jam.
Oh.
But or just put it in a bowl and perfume your whole house. You have a wonderful recipe in there for quince, a stuffed quince. Tell me about that.
Well, this, before I explain, before I describe the quince, the stuffed quince, I just want to tell you that, for example, when I was growing up, cutting the potatoes in quarters, it was called kidonates, which means quince-like, which make me think that in the old days, when potatoes were not available, because potatoes again came much later to the Mediterranean, they were using quince instead of potatoes, because we have the most common dish in Greece and all over the Mediterranean is meat cooked with quince, either pork or lamb or anything. But stuffed quince is also another thing, and my stuffed quince is with farro or with wheat berries, which you pre-boil, and then you saute it with spices and nuts and sultanas, and you stuff the quince. You bake the quince, and
you have to soften it.
First, and then you empty it. But quince doesn't collapse when it's baked, and it has this slightly tart flavor, which is absolutely fantastic with any kind of stuffing, be it meat or with a good flavoring, well flavored. And I use the same spices that I use in my meat stuffings. And it makes it, and together with the walnuts or the almonds, You can use any nuts, or you can use, I mean, we use walnuts because walnut is what we have. But we use pecans here, which are absolutely fantastic. So together with the pecans, let's say, and the wheat berries, they create a flavor that you don't know that it is without meat, actually.
All right. Right, interesting. Well, and you yourself are not a vegetarian.
I'm not a vegetarian.
I eat
meat right. every now and then.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for sharing all this information. This is a book that's going to make people's mouths water, and they won't even miss the meat.
But it really is, and
the reason I chose to present it on the show is because it really is like a step back in time, because you are using foods that have been around forever, for millennia.
You know, and exactly.
And the techniques are, although we may use a food processor rather than
hand
grating. Yeah. But hey, yeah. Look at you roll your own phyllo dough. How much older of a technique can you get? I admire that. I do. And it has been a pleasure. And
I
cannot wait to visit and see what it's all about out there.
Thank you.
This has been A Taste of the Past, and I'm your host, Linda Palacio. My guest has been Aglaia Cremesi, and her book is Mediterranean Vegetarian Feasts. Thanks for listening.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.